The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Connect with ultra-fast speeds and our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, mother and daughter Anne and Sabrina Boyd told me about their work as carers, which has seen them both receive the Carer of the Year award. In March, I spoke about the decision taken to suspend the rents in the Georgia Street Arcade. Landlord Gwen Layden talked to me about this act of kindness and her passion for letting business flourish in the arcade. Vogue Williams is one of the many people overseas worrying about whether or not they'll make it home in the coming months. And she talked to me about missing Ireland, her family, and a good chipper. Claire told me about the circumstances that saw her giving birth to her daughter Deborah in Bessborough Mother and Baby Home, and how a kind word changed both their lives forever. And American investigative journalist Bob Woodward spoke to me about this fascinating chapter in US political history as Election Day looms ever closer. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. There are two people I really wanted to meet. I'm going to start with Sabrina Boyd. Good morning, Sabrina.
Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
How are you and where are you?
I'm in Greenmount in Cork City.
Oh, I was really keen to talk to you because you won a great award recently and I want to talk to you a little bit about that. What did you become?
So I became the National Carer of the Year for Ireland for a company called Right at Home. We're a home care company that look after the elderly and vulnerable in the community.
Well, congratulations on your win, but more importantly, congratulations on your work, because given the day that's in it, we need to be talking about people like you and people like the folks that you work with, your clients and your friends. Tell us a bit about yourself. I mean, you didn't always work in the caring business, if you want to call it that. What did you do before that?
So before that, I was working in retail. So I worked in retail most of my life when I finished school and went to college.
Yeah.
And then I had a family of my own, Ryan. I have three kids. I have two boys and a girl. And I suppose when you're in retail, you kind of get stuck in a rut because you have a family. And it just came to a point in my life where I said, look, if I don't go back to college now and do what I always wanted to do, I don't think I'll ever do it. So with the support of my partner and my family, I went back to college, and it's something that I don't regret. The only thing I regret is that I didn't do it sooner.
Well, tell me, when I hear retail, I presume that means shops and all the rest of it.
I worked in management level.
Yeah, in where?
So I worked for Heaton's, I worked for Super Value, and I worked for Dunn Stores.
All the greats.
All the greats.
And were the hours long, and was the work tough?
Yeah, the hours were very long, especially when you're at management level. You're expected to do a lot more than you would if you were just a normal employee. So there were some weeks there you could work 50, 60 hours a week.
Okay, that is a long
week. And especially if you had head office visits, you'd be expected to stay longer.
With
a family, it wasn't suiting to be doing that many hours anyway, and to have my partner at home with the kids all the time, and I missed out on quite a lot with the kids working those long hours.
So you said, I'm going back to college. I want to change direction entirely. A lot of people wouldn't have the nerve to do that, but you did it. And you went back to study what?
So I went back to study a VTAC level 5 for healthcare. So I suppose there was a lot of talk about it, whether I would go back or not. But as I said, I have a very strong family support. So I did go back and I gave up retail. I gave up everything and I went back for the year and I studied to become a carer. And I'm absolutely delighted that I did.
This is a kind of an odd question, but in terms of take-home pay from the shops that you worked in versus the caring situation, was there much of a difference between the two?
A big one, yeah. So I'm not going to tell exactly how much.
No, I don't mean the exact details. I'd never ask you that.
It was more than half.
You took a pay cut of pretty much more than half?
Yeah.
And
because
people...
I suppose I took it, Ryan, because it was something that I wanted to do. My passion was there for it. And I absolutely, like, no 2 days in this job are the same.
So the vocation was more important to you than the paycheck?
It was. Like, I knew it was my calling, and I definitely knew that it was something that I wanted to do. Whereas when I was in retail, I was doing it for the paycheck.
Tell me what it involves, Sabrina. What do you do that brings you so much joy and satisfaction, if you like?
For me, it's allowing the elderly and the vulnerable to live independent lives, to allow them to stay at home, that they're not put into nursing homes. We're there to care for them. We're there to go in and assist them to do whatever they need, whether it's personal care, whether it's taking their mind off this current pandemic, whether it's listening to them. That's a big thing, listening to them. Let them talk. Let them say what they want to say. Like for me personally, you build up. I have the same clients now for the last 2.5 years, and you build up that kind of a friendship with them that they know they can talk to you about anything. They know they can say anything to you. And for me, that's fantastic, knowing that they're not alone, that you're going into them on a daily basis, and they know they have somebody going into them that they can talk to, that like... I go in and I'd be singing, I'd be dancing with them, I'd be bringing in my Lexa, and if they like any particular songs or movies, I'd play it for them. And it's just, I don't know, it's just a great satisfaction knowing that you've helped keep them out of the hospitals and out of the nursing homes, and that you're there helping them live independently as possible.
What is the, Sabrina, what's the kind of most common thread that runs between the stories of all the people you visit? What do they most want to talk about?
A lot of them reminisce about the past. So like a lot of them at the moment do not want to talk about anything related to the COVID. They are just sick of it.
Yep.
Like we all are. I understand that. But a lot of them reminisce about the past. Like one of my clients has written a book.
Okay.
And one of my clients writes poetry. So like they reminisce about like their life. Like one man now, his life was on a farm, and he'd reminisce about the farm days. And another client would reminisce about... she has family abroad and how much she misses them. It doesn't matter what they want to speak about. I'm there to listen.
Mm.
Because like it's nice for them, because sometimes you're the only person, Ryan, that they might see from one end of the day to the other. Like they might see nobody, only you, the carer, going into them.
What music do they want to hear?
Well, one of my clients loves K Sarah Sarah, What Will Be Will Be.
Yeah.
And he'd reminisce that. Most mornings he would sing that to me. And we'd be inside in the kitchen, and together we'd be singing out loud, K Sarah, we'd be singing it out loud together.
Well, that could be an anthem for our times.
Well, that's true. Very true. Very true.
And when you go home after a day visiting clients and people around the place,
yeah.
You go home to your own family.
Yeah.
Who do you think about in terms of who you visited? What do you think about your day as you reflect, if you've time?
It's very hard to come home, Ryan, and to switch off.
Yeah.
You can't do that. You'll be thinking, are your clients okay? Like, if you're not there, like I always let them know that I'm on the end of the phone if they ever need anything. Don't be afraid to call me. Like most of my clients live near me. So I would always say, if you want anything or need anything, you know where I am. Pick up the phone. Don't hesitate to call me. And if I can assist you in any way, I will assist you. So it's very hard to switch off when you come back. But I suppose, Ryan, you have to switch off when you have kids.
Yeah.
Like my youngest kid is 17 months.
Oh, right. Okay. Baby.
So he's a baby. And my eldest is 8. And I have a girl of 5.
Oh,
so my kids are quite young.
What sort of sense of satisfaction, and I'm talking about your soul now, Sabrina, how do you feel in your soul at the end of a long day visiting clients compared to a long day working in retail?
I suppose in being a carer, you feel more, it's hard to put into words, but you feel that you've done a great job. You feel satisfied. You have a great job satisfaction. That you know that you've helped somebody, that you've assisted them, you have whatever they need done, that you have done for them. Whereas in retail, the hours are so long. It's the same thing every day. You come out of it and you're tired. In this job, you're not tired because you're doing a job that you love.
Yeah, you've got two sisters.
I do.
Name?
Sharon and Tina.
Sharon and Tina. What do they do for a living?
So Tina works down in a place called Carrigley, and she works with people that are kind of mentally challenged.
She's a carer.
She's a carer.
And Sharon?
Sharon is... she's also a carer, but she's not qualified. So she works in the caring industry, but on a different level to us.
And has anyone in your family won the Carer of the Year award before you?
My mom.
So this is a gene.
It is.
This is a hereditary gene of kindness and caring. And tell me, your mum is?
So my mom's name is Anne Boyd.
And when did she win the award?
And she won the award only 8 years ago, back in 2012.
And how would you describe your mum to me as her daughter?
My mom is one in a million, and I'm not just saying that. She is the best mom and nanny and granny ever.
Why?
Because she does everything for everyone and never thinks of herself. She's not one bit selfish. Like, she won that award because when she retired, she still continued to go up to this lady, Sheila. And she went up to her voluntary. No pay, no nothing. My mum done it.
Well, let's say hello to your mum, will we?
We will.
Anne Boyd, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan. I won't be able to talk as good as my daughter now, Ryan. How are you?
I doubt that. What a pleasure to talk to you. And congratulations all these years later on your award win in 2012.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
How do you think it is, Anne, that your three daughters, Sharon and Tina and Sabrina, who we're talking to this morning, are all working in the same business? That is to say, caring for their fellow man and woman. How did that happen?
I think it's kind of a history kind of a thing, Ryan. I might ramble on a bit now, so don't take any notes of me. I'm from Greigna Manor originally, from Greigna Manor, County Kilkenny. And what I saw growing up in my family, my dad died when he was 42 from TB. And there was five of us in the family, Ryan. And my God, going back a long time now, Ryan. Mm. And my mother had to do everything. There was no money. There was no nothing. Neighbours were good. I left school when I was 10 and I was cleaning houses.
So you had to fend for yourself from an early age, obviously.
We all did, Ryan. My sisters and my brothers. We also had a sister, Bridget, who got TB as well. And she went up to Dublin and she was up there for 8 years and we never had the money to go up and see her.
Okay, the difficult times for you all at that stage.
My mother was the one that held us all together, Ryan.
And you met Pat.
I met Pat in London.
And what was Pat doing at the time?
He was a sailor.
He was a sailor. And what else did he do after that?
He was doing, he'd done building sites and stuff like that. He'd done every kind of a job, really, Ryan. He'd done every kind of job.
Sounds kind of useful to have around the place.
Kind of, well, I suppose.
Building, sailing ships, whatever
everything.
You need. Yeah, no, it's pretty great. But the reason, in some ways, you won the Care of the Year award all these years ago, 8 years ago, was because of a lady called Sheila. And Sheila was, she was fragile, I think is the word that has been used to describe her at the time that you met her. And she didn't trust a lot of people, but she trusted you.
I tell you how I met Sheila, right? And our son and my husband done chimney sweep. And my son, Martin, used to go into Sheila, we say once a year, to clean the chimney. And he came home to me one day and he said, Mammy, he said, there's a lady up the road. He said, and I think he said she could do with a bit of help. And Ryan, you just don't walk into somebody and say, look at sir, I'm going to do something for you, or something like that.
Yeah.
But I got onto the health nurses here in Mahon. And they said, she went up first. And she wasn't the type of person like anybody near her. Now, I can't say why, because there's a lot of personal
things okay,
went
yeah.
on in their life as well.
That's okay.
But we went everywhere together, Ryan. She got me out as well, Ryan, because I don't drink, like, and... the community here in Mahon were brilliant. You go out to the over 60s. We went everywhere together. We went to the doctors. We went to the supermarket. And when she wasn't able to go anywhere then, we'd bring her in the car. So she was never, she just had a very tough life. And like Sabrina would say, she grew up with our family. You see, she came to all the family birthday parties, wedding wake, you name it, funerals, everything. And she came down to all our, when the children got older, she came down to all the Christmas dinners. Sheila was always at the table. But the trust, the thing, as Sabrina was saying, is to build up trust is the most important thing, Ryan, with anyone.
It's amazing, though, Anne, to hear you say that a Christmas table, obviously it's going to be a very different Christmas table, I think, maybe this year. But parking that for a moment, it's such an important thing. And I saw my own mother doing it before. She used to have a lovely expression, just throw another couple of potatoes in the pot. In other words, it's a very Christian thing to do, without being overly religious. It's a very kind thing to do.
Well, if somebody's living on their own, Ryan, and they're living on their own. Now, no, some people may say, no, look, I don't want to go down. And that's fine. And Sheila used to say to me, look, I don't want to be interfering with your family. But my family were quite young at the time. And if Sheila wasn't there, it wouldn't be the same. And for the 10 or 20 years I was looking after her, she was everything, every wake, every funeral, and every, as she would say, every wake, every funeral. We just brought her everywhere.
And what did she refer to you as?
Ma'am.
Ma'am. And she, and your husband?
Dad.
And how old was she in terms of what was the age gap between you and Sheila?
Oh, I said about 20 years, I'd say. She was actually 80 something when she died.
So she was older than you, but called you Ma'am and Dad.
Yeah. Oh, she called me. She came out. Even if we're out shopping or anything like that, she called us Ma'am and Dad. But she was a good person. She was a good person, but had a hard life.
I understand. And she passed away, sadly?
About 8 or 9 years ago. We have a headstone here over in Black Rock, that if ever we pop the bucket or something like that. And we always went for a walk, myself and Sheila, just around Mahon and Black Rock when she was able.
Yeah.
And we went over to this grave and I said, we'll have to get the headstone, Sheila. So we'll go down and get it. She had a wheelchair this time. And there was a plot right across from our grave. And she said, I'm going to buy that.
She knew straight away.
She says, when I'm gone, she says, and you and Dad are gone, she said, and your children and your grandchildren will come down to the grave and say, oh yeah, that's Sheila there. So she says, I'll always have visitors. That's sad, really, I know.
I think it's more happy than sad, because she knew that she wasn't going to disappear off the face of the earth without being thought about or remembered. So there's actually quite a lot of dignity in what she observed there. And does the gravestone have anything written on it of note?
Yes. It's just Sheila Rycroft. And any morning I went into her house, and I went up 2 or 3 times a day, Ryan. I'm not bragging about it, it's just something for me to do as well. And it's just any news.
So the tombstone says, the gravestone says,
any news. That's it. Because I tell you, Ryan, she was very nosy, right? And if there was any commotion, she'd love somebody to have a fight outside the door now. And she'd stand out, she'd say, go on, give it the best you can, like, and I'd kill it away. But you see, I got to know so many people because of Sheila as well, Ryan. Like, because
I understand.
When you don't tend to socialise and you have a young family and stuff like that. But no, we go to the grave every day, myself and my husband.
Do you really? I mean, it is the most Irish gravestone inscription I think I've ever heard. Any news?
I enjoyed myself. We went everywhere together. We'd done everything together. And she had a dog named Jacko. And the dog came with us as well.
All the gang.
All the gang.
Sabrina, can I ask you just to bring you back in again as Anne's daughter? There are a lot of people listening this morning and we're facing into a long day and they're very concerned about the next 3, 4, 5 weeks and what have you. And the days are getting shorter, as you know, and Christmas is coming around the corner and so on and so forth. The pair of you and your whole family obviously have some gene in you that is deeply thoughtful and desperately kind. What do you say to people, particularly those of a certain age, and then those, regardless of what age they are, who are on their own, what can you say to them to maybe make them feel a little less frightened or lonely today?
That's a very tough question.
I understand.
Because with all the media that's going on about this virus at the moment, it's very hard to say, don't watch the news, don't watch this. But just to let them know that there's always people out there for them that they can ring if they ever need anything, if they wanted anything. There's always help in the community. Never feel alone. That's the major thing, Ryan, with this virus at the moment. People are alone. People are isolated. Just to let people know that they're never alone. They're never isolated. Whether, like my mom said there, it's ringing somebody in the community, whether it's the community guard, whether it's the public health nurse. I would advise people out there, please check on your neighbours. If you have elderly neighbours, if you have neighbours that you haven't seen in a couple of days, they don't have to be elderly, please just knock on the door and check, are you okay? Do you need anything? That's the main thing, is for people in the community out there to reach out to their neighbours who they haven't seen in a while or know that are vulnerable, that they will just go, please, and check on them and make sure that they're okay.
Wise words. You know, in some ways, I would urge people, don't wait on somebody to be kind. Be that kind person.
Kindness is nothing, Ryan. It costs nothing to be nice.
Sabrina and Anne, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you both. Congratulations on the awards you've won, but more importantly, for being the people that you are. Thank you for your time
this
morning.
Thank you.
you very
thank
much,
you very
Ryan. Appreciate
much,
that.
Ryan.
Thank you very
lovely
much.
Talking to you,
and
Ryan.
You. Take
thank
care
you
yourself.
So much, Ryan. You
bye.
Too.
Thank you, Ryan.
Bye,
Ryan.
Bye,
Sabrina.
That's the Boyds there in a salutary lesson in life on a Monday morning in a world gone mad. The text number 51551. There's a great arcade, as it's called, the Georgia Street Arcade in Dublin. So many of you will have walked through it, and they have some super shops in there. Did I say that? Great shops in there. And I was only there the other day, as I always do. My Fox jumper, I got it in the shop there, the kind of vintage clothes shop there. And they very kindly, Spin Dizzy Records, very kindly sent me a Paul McCartney album, a vinyl album, as just to say hello and thanks or whatever it might be. But it was a lovely gift of them. But it came with a poem from the woman who is the landlord and owner of the Georgia Street Arcade. And I thought I'd like to talk to her. And Gwen, good morning.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
You too. Thank you so much. We really, you have been so kind. It's so appreciated. I couldn't tell you. It's so uplifting.
Don't mention
what you did this morning now for all of our 40 businesses that be feeding Plum and all over Ireland. That really was a lovely start toward all our days.
It's just don't mention it. I just think people put their backs and their blood, sweat and tears into these businesses. And
yes.
We have to remember them and not to
yes.
be flitting off to internet land and to other places. But look, the reason you were on my mind,
more.
Gwen, sorry, the reason you were on my mind was because you were mentioned in dispatches on this programme a few months ago when the COVID kicked in. Because if I'm not mistaken, during the last lockdown, you refused to charge rent to the tenants in mm-hmm. the arcade. Is that correct?
Yes.
And why
yes.
did you do that?
Well, I'll tell you, Ryan, I suppose about 40 small businesses in there, and we're a family ourselves, you know, so not many shopping centres are still owned by families in Ireland. Most of them, I suppose, are owned by big companies or funds. So to be honest with you, I'm good friends with every single person in there, and I have 40, say, odd people. I mean, many of them are from abroad now, which has added a great richness to our business, and I love to see somebody come in from abroad.
Mm.
I never ask for a bank reference. I've never looked for any of that. I just chat to the person. And most of those people, it's their passion. You know, it's something they love. So, like, Stephen Stokes is there for 37 years and he loves books.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to get really commercial on that because at the end of the day, Ryan, you know, that arcade will be owned by some other Gwen Layden in 100 years' time. And, I mean, the legacy you want to leave is, did you allow people open up a business easily in their lifetime? Because the dignity that comes from owning your own business and you can provide for your family, and that's worth more to me than any money in the world, you know, to walk in there and see the people arrive sometimes with absolutely nothing from a foreign country or sometimes from Dublin but they never have got a start before, and to let them do what they love. And it's the right thing to do. And, you know, I mean, really, I know everyone is feeling so forlorn this morning and there's bills to be paid, and I know that more than most, because obviously businesses have loans and it's all school fees and all sorts of stuff. But the best things in life actually genuinely are free, providing you can put food on the table.
So yeah, go ahead.
If I don't need more than to be able to cover my needs. And then it is just so much more rewarding to see the tenants and to give it back to them and make sure that they can all put food on their table. And then, you know, you walk out in the evening and the sky is beautiful. You know, there's so many things that can get you through the day that you don't have to buy. But you do need a certain amount.
Yes.
And that's why I know it sounds Pollyannish and all of that, but it does work if everyone shares. And I'm lucky enough to have this building, but I don't need to profit from it too much. Do you know?
I do. I understand. And
so,
you, just for people who haven't been to the arcade, you know, it really is it's such a marvel. And it is it's always been charming from since I was a kid going in. I bought a Beatles jacket there from the secondhand clothes guys back when I was in my early 20s. I got my Fox jumper from the vintage shop there?
Retro,
brilliant shop.
Yeah.
Great stuff
yeah.
in there.
Debbie Harry shops there.
Oh, well, I'm not surprised
to hear that.
And Imelda May, yeah, I can
and
see that.
And lots of very normal other people.
And normal people as well. But I was only there 2 Sundays ago. The tarot card reading is still there with the wonderful velour curtains.
I love Julian de Burgh.
Is that who
yeah.
that is? Okay.
Yeah. And it was Mrs. Murphy before him.
Oh, brilliant.
And he's just, you know, that's the thing, Ryan. Like, he's put a lovely light now up and You know, each one of them makes such an effort. I had a man from Nepal, and he came a long way to get to here. And I didn't know anything about him. He just arrived, and he had a lovely, smiling face. And he wanted to sell Irish tourist goods, you know, which is kind of funny, being the guy from Nepal. But anyway, the poor man, and he stocked his stall with Irish tourist goods, and bang, March, it all went. He turned around, and he's selling face masks now, and funny T-shirts. But that's the kind of resilience. And so if you can bear with people, if anybody like me out there can ask their banks to hold off on maybe taking repayments, that's a biggie for businesses like me. And that we then can support the businesses that are under our care, because I think they are in our care, you know. And it is, I'd really recommend it. You know, it's a good way.
So you didn't charge rent during the lockdown, correct?
No.
At the last lockdown. And then when they reopened in June, you gave them a month's reprieve.
Well, we didn't, we let them get, you know, kind of feel good and make a bit of money for a month. We didn't ask them for anything. And then we asked for 25%. And then we asked for 50%. So, and now we're back to square one again. So, you know, we'll just have to see. And then there's a few, Ryan, you know, and just one or two who I carried through because they needed it. You know,
and
you kind of know the ones who need it.
But
then you do have to insure your building and pay your bills.
Of course.
It's not easy.
No.
I'm making it sound easy, but it's actually not. But I mean, we're lucky, it's a family business. My father's 74. He's the so-called cocooners, and he's about to head into another recession. But so, you know, we're lucky we're a family business, so I don't need to. We're all singing from the same hymn sheet.
Yeah.
So it makes it easier.
I'm not a businessman. And I haven't a business bone in my body, to be quite honest with you.
Probably don't either.
maybe you're too kind.
No.
But the point I'm making, Gwen, is that whenever I hear the business news and business people, and I'm not talking about inter-global conglomerates. I'm talking about the good eggs who are just trying to make a book. Rents seem to be a perpetual problem, particularly in cities, and that they seem to be prohibitive, really, for a lot of people. And what I love about your story is, You're a landlady, or a landlord, I don't know, but you've got a conscience and a heart that doesn't seem to be widespread in that world.
Well, you know, the funny thing, Ryan, is I have no unlet properties and I have no arrears. So, like, as a business model, it works.
It does.
You know,
I
don't know how nobody, like, you have to just accept the world for what it is. And if there's a shutter down, if you see a shutter down, I think that's immoral, because someone somewhere would love that shop.
That's so true.
And you're getting nothing for it. So you may as well just accept whatever somebody's willing to give you. But there is, look, there is a moral conscience. I mean, I'm a daily mass goer, and I would always check in with above. Am I doing the right thing?
Okay.
In a very calm kind of way, in a zealotry way. But I mean, you don't have to. It's nothing to do with that. It works. It works, Ryan, for business. It works as a businesswoman.
Yeah.
I never have an arrear. I have a wonderful relationship. We don't use lawyers, with all the tenants, and it just goes. You know, it works business wise, and it works as well. That's at the end of the day. You know, when you put your head on the pillow, over a course of 30 years now doing it, and, you know, it's far more important that you feel that people have had a good time, pleasant time.
I'm so glad we spoke this morning, Gwen.
Yeah.
It's been lovely to talk to you.
You too.
Yeah.
Thank you. I really mean it. We are so grateful. I've been watching The Late Late now for, I suppose, 40-odd years, and I still wouldn't miss it on a Friday night. So thank you for that.
Well,
also,
thank you for your support. I will send that fiver in the post. Gwen, thank you so much. Look after yourself. And best to everyone at the
we're
arcade.
We're most grateful, Ryan.
Don't mention
really
it.
Are.
Okay, thank you.
So
that's
much.
Gwen
Bye.
Layden. And as Anne says, George Street Arcade is a gem in Dublin. What a wonderful woman Gwen Layden is. What a great attitude. Vogue Williams, good morning.
Good morning, Ryan. Long time no chat.
Long time no nothing. And here we are. You are so you're so busy, an unending whirlwind of activity. How's life?
Life is as good as it can be, actually. It's really good. The only thing is I'm missing home.
Yeah.
But besides that, everything is brilliant.
Okay, so we've spoken about your son, Theodore, who's two, but we haven't mentioned the girl.
Gigi.
What's her full name?
Gigi Margot Matthews.
Well, that's a gorgeous name. Gigi, why did you call her that?
Oh, you know what? We both, Margot was Benny's first choice, I think. And that got vetoed by me. I had a different one, and then we both actually came to Gigi and we just absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I
think it's a really nice name. It's a name that I'd like to have for myself, so I thought that'll be good enough for Gigi.
I think you did all right now in the unusual and brilliant names front yourself now, so don't be too worried about that.
Mine's a little bit out there, though.
But Gigi Margot, Margot spelled the French way, is it? With an A-U-X?
Yeah. Yeah, because Spenny is, well, he's fluent in French. He grew up in St. Barth, so it's his little French twist to her name.
Nice one. And how is she? How's Gigi?
She is fab. She's still not sleeping through the night, but we won't hold that against her. Theodore was sleeping through pretty early, so I was kind of expecting the same thing from her, but not yet. But she's actually such a good baby. She's really relaxed and just chill, and she's able to take Theodore coming over and kind of been a little less than gentle with her, but he loves her really.
He's doing that thing that they do, the love baby. Love baby, love baby. Squeeze baby's head, love baby. And you're going, don't.
Exactly. Push my head really hard against her head, I love the baby.
Yeah. I love this interloping child that's wrecking my buzz. It's so funny, isn't it? I remember speaking to a few people when they were having their first children in particular. And they were kind of getting a bit nervous. And I said, can I just say to you, even to dads as well, I said, one thing you'll learn when you're having your baby is that people will come up to you and tell you all the most horrible things about being a parent, especially in the early days, or being pregnant. That, I don't know if it's an Irish thing or if it's happened in the UK. They take a weird, ghoulish joy in saying, it's awful. It's awful.
I know. And I find that people are like, oh, well, you better sleep now because you'll never sleep when
never
the baby
sleep
arrives.
Again.
I'm actually... It's not true. I don't find that true. I think that I was way more wrecked during pregnancy than I am now that Gigi's here. And I think people make you feel really nervous about it. And I don't think that, like, of course it's difficult, but it's the most amazing thing ever. And you kind of just, you don't realize the difficulties because you kind of are just in a bubble of love already. So I'd never give someone the negatives because that really annoys me. It mainly happened with when I was having Theodore, and I just thought, God, just be happy. It's fine.
Yeah, and enjoy it. And yes, it can be tricky, and yes, it's a whole new world order, but it's not helped by you telling me how awful it's going to be. I'm doing fine on my own, you know?
Exactly. I don't need to know about it,
I remember talking to you, Vogue, in Malahide when we were in the chip van doing a show from there years ago, and you spoke about your dad. Do you mind if I mention your dad this morning?
No, I don't mind.
And the reason I bring him up is because I remember how beautifully you spoke about him. And I was wondering, you know, now that you're a mum, do you think about him? And, I mean, obviously you would have loved him to have met the kids and so on, but do you think about him quite a bit?
I still think about him probably every day. And I think that, like, one of my friends just lost her mom recently, and I said, you know, it's really, really hard now. But, like, eventually you get to a point where you just think really fondly of them. And it is more or less every day, but... I think it would have been amazing had he been able to meet the kids. But sure, most of my family haven't met her either because she was born, obviously, during lockdown. So my mum has met her, my stepdad's met her, and that's kind of it of my whole family. So still waiting.
Still waiting. So you're you're in London, is that right?
I'm in London.
You're in London. So what's the vibe there? I mean, we've just got into, well, we're heading towards our second lockdown here. You probably heard the news, but people are a little bit exasperated. But how about you?
Well, do you know what? It's definitely the better place to be. I think at the moment there's certainly different measures, but everyone is wearing their masks. You can go out for dinner, but with six people from your own kind of family. You have to be home by 10. So we've restrictions like that, which I think are quite good, and they are working because the numbers aren't shooting up so high in London. And I just got, when I heard that news about Ireland yesterday, my heart just sank for so many businesses that probably won't now make it through all of this. And I just feel terrible for them, and just, I don't know. It's really sad, to be honest.
It's a trick. I keep saying tricky but it's actually, that's just a polite word of saying it's probably a little worse than that. And I've always wondered then for you, because anytime we speak, you strike me as being a home bird, a real, like, you love Ireland, you love Howth and so on. So how do you marry your sort of London-centric life with a love of Howth?
God, I love Howth so much.
What are you missing about Howth?
I miss everything about Howth. I miss all my friends. Like, Howth is kind of like its own little bubble. I love the cliff walk. I just, when I get home to Ireland, this doesn't even necessarily have to be Howth. Just being home in Ireland, I think when you're Irish, you just have that in your blood and it's just there forever. And Ireland will always be home. And I haven't been back since November, so almost going on a year. And it's the longest, obviously, I've ever spent away. And I just think it's the nicest country ever. I really miss Irish sausages. I've been ordering my Barry's tea on Amazon, so that's okay. But I just kind of miss... I want a chipper. I want to get a Chinese from home. I miss everything.
Okay, let's drill down here, as I say in America. Let's drill down. If you're going to the chipper, what's the name of the chipper? Is it a Borza's or a Prelay or what is it?
We used to have an amazing one called Cafe Cara in Howth. Now we have a Beshoff and a Leo Burdock's. So I usually go for Leo Burdock's.
Okay, imagine you're in Burdock's, right? You can smell the vinegar right from behind the counter. You can see the lads putting the potatoes into the oil. And
the crispy bits.
Yes, and they're looking at you're looking at the menu, even though you know what you want. What are you ordering?
Quarter pounder chips, garlic sauce, so much vinegar on my chips that like it starts seeping through the box, and a little bit of salt.
And to drink?
To drink Fanta, probably.
Like a cold can of Fanta.
I'd probably go for a bottle.
Oh, would you? Oh, an aristocrat.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've already had the worst meal ever. I might as well go large on the drink.
Where would you eat it?
I would eat it in my new house that I haven't been in since I bought it in March.
Well, I'll come back to that. Would you, when you're taking it home in the bag in your car, would you... go for
100%.
The... Yeah, you would, wouldn't you? You'd raid the bag before you get home.
Who can get home? I mean, I used to live right beside it and it would take me about 30 seconds to walk home and I'd still be stuffing my face.
Because they taste better when you're stealing them from the bag on the way home.
And you know what? A chipper is nicer in Ireland. I think over here they think the chippers are the best. They're not. They're not nearly the same as the chippers in Ireland.
So you haven't been home since November?
Yeah, because I was
long time.
Back here, and then when I was able to possibly travel to Ireland, I was due the baby, so I couldn't actually travel. And then I thought, okay, I'll go back in August. And I've had a few trips booked back to even just go and stay in my house for 5 days. But like, I just feel like it makes people feel uncomfortable at the moment. And until the rules change, I won't be able to go home. But as soon as they change,
yes,
I'm getting on a flight and I'm going straight back. But I did see in Heathrow Airport they're starting to bring in testing that you can do like just before you fly to Hong Kong and places like that.
Yeah.
So I'm just hoping that happens for Ireland.
And will you go to the new house first or the chipper first?
I might hit the chipper on the way up.
I'm actually thinking about it already. I've already planned, I think, a visit on later on myself on the basis of this conversation because it's just too good.
Delicious. Send me a picture.
Do you know what? I will actually. I'll send it to you later on. And is Amber, is your sister helping out here? Is she like your ambassador, your representative on earth here in Ireland?
Amber, is, she's my unwilling project manager at home. So she's been kind of dealing with everybody and the place is finished now. So at least she's up there and she can enjoy it. One of us is enjoying it.
And what about your mum? She's an Instagram superstar.
Amber is?
No, your mum.
Oh, I know. Yeah, she's getting on great. She loves it though.
Yeah.
And she's really, really stylish. Like I see stuff on my mom all the time and I'm like, I'm going to steal that as soon as I get near you. And she loves it because she's always really glamorous and really dressed up. And now she's roped my stepdad into taking pictures of her. So that's kind of her thing now.
When you get home, come and see us and say hello because it's been too long. In the meantime, to you and Spencer and Gigi Margot and Theodore, every happiness and good wish.
Thank you. And we'll be watching you on the toy show.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's happening last Friday in November. We'll see you then. We'll give you a wave.
Yay.
See you, Vogue.
Okay, talk to you later.
Bye for now. Vogue Williams joining us from London Town. It's amazing, really, when you present this programme and you find yourself talking about, of all things, creatures. And in this case, the puffin. And, you know, some people think that I'm crazy because I don't believe puffins exist. And some people believe in them. And people like Deborah Donnelly who got in touch with us. Good morning to you, Deborah.
Good morning, Ryan.
It was the puffin that brought you to our attention in some ways.
Yes, because they are real. They do exist.
I know. I think that's cute that you think that. And you're an artist.
Yes.
And why did you get in touch?
You stirred me when you said puffins are from the imagination. So that was a trigger.
That started it.
Yeah, I've started painting puffins because they're actually a sign of wellness during COVID. And they're the Ireland's longest living bird. And my favourite part about them is that when they mate, they share the chores equally of, you know, family life.
What progressive animals they are. No, no wonder
I should have married a puffin.
No wonder they're not real. So I didn't realise that they were essentially...
Oh yeah, I think that's why I'm drawn to them. But I do a lot of wellness classes and videos. So I think that's why I'm drawn to the puffin.
What have the puffin got to do with wellness?
Well, because they're Ireland's longest living bird.
Okay.
They lived in their 30s.
How do you know they're not living in sufferance? I mean, have you interviewed one?
Because they're sharing the chores, I imagine it makes things a lot easier.
I refer you to my last question. Anyway, you got in touch about the puffin and we got talking to you and we found that you're an artist, but also your mother, Claire, is an artist.
Yes.
And between the pair of you, the shared bond. But in fact, the real story here, it lies in the not too distant past. And that's why we also asked your mother, Claire, to join us this morning. Good morning, Claire, and thanks
for
being here.
Good morning, Ryan. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Your story is intriguing because 44 years ago this week, where did you find yourself and why?
I found myself pregnant and I did a lot of crying and then I sought an agent. There was an agency, you know, in the papers, there's always a little ad about if you're pregnant, and I contacted this agency, and obviously a Catholic agency. And then they arranged for me to go down to Bessborough in Cork, a mother and baby home.
You were what age at that time?
I was 27, probably going on 28.
You weren't a whippersnapper.
This is it. I was an idiot. I was the younger half of a family of 10. But I spent my whole childhood reading encyclopedias and drawing and just sketching all around me. My father used to say, would you give it a rest? Because I think at that time, it's very hard to make a living at art, you know.
Sure, sure.
But I arrived down in Bessborough and I got a great welcome. I found I was given a new identity. They called me Cynthia. And I had a private cubicle. There were corridors of cubicles where you had your own cubicle. And an allowance, actually got a weekly allowance as well. And I just found this was a lovely place to hide away. What I was worried about were my parents finding out, because my father was a well-respected person in Dalkey. He was the home assistance officer in the dispensary. So once that was covered, and also I found at the time I told my parents that I was going to England to get a job.
Yeah.
And I was able to write letters to my parents and the nuns would send the letters to their English convent and post them from England.
To allow the illusion of you being working in England.
Yes, yes.
So when you found yourself at the mother and child home, was there, because it was 44 years ago, different times.
Oh, absolutely,
Were you worried going down there or did you feel it was unfair that you had to go down there or did you feel it was a place of sanctuary?
The latter. I didn't do a lot of thinking. I just had to deal with the situation. And my first priority was not to let my parents find out. And from there, then, one thing followed another. First of all, when I found Bessborough, it was situated on the banks of a river and it was very spacious and everyone seemed to be cheerful.
Really?
Believe it or not, yeah.
I don't believe it because I've never heard of a cheerful mother and child home in Ireland.
Well, I suppose in greetings, and there was a lot of humour. You know, with this COVID, the humour comes out.
Yeah, the dark humour.
Yeah, and with these corridors, there was no ceiling on them, with the cubicles. So at night, you could hear girls and women talking, and then you'd hear laughter, and then you'd hear you'd be kind of shocked a bit at some of the stories, and then feel sorrow as well.
What sort of stories would you hear?
There was a 12 or 13-year-old child down there and she was carrying a baby. And in the end, her mother, who had 12 children or something, just came up, collected her and the baby. There was another girl there and she was a student and she just came in very late in her pregnancy, was going to have the baby, get the child adopted, back to college. And I heard from the sisters, one sister in particular, afterwards that she had a complete breakdown. Parents were in touch with them and obviously she probably kept the child, I don't know.
Yeah, gosh, all these stories and so difficult. And in fact, people will be listening this morning who will have been either the mother or the child in these stories. And they, it's a hard thing to listen to. But I'll focus on your own story then, if I can, and by asking you, when it came to have the child,
yes,
what was on your mind in terms of where this baby was going to end up?
Well, this is the problem. I didn't think. It maybe it's the hormones. I kind of blacked everything out. Mm. I just kept for the moment. I ate well. In fact, Sister Ambrosia was this jovial sister, lovely face, smiling face. She was over the kitchen.
Yeah.
And I thought the food, I enjoyed the food. I used to swap my dessert for the meat. Took exercises. I looked after.
And had you blanked out what was going to happen next? Is that what you think?
I didn't think ahead. Yeah. That's hard to believe. I just focused on the... It all hit me like a ton of bricks when Deborah was born. The waterworks came. Every time Johnny Mathis sang that song, "When a Child is Born," and that went on for the year, like, you know. But, and then I thought very deeply. I was walking the floors at night and I met this old midwife. I hadn't seen her before. And she said, "What are you doing up? Go back to bed. Pull in your stomach, you know. Yeah. What good are you to your child if you're walking the floor? Go back." So, we were shown films of children in a lovely setting who were adopted and looked ideal. And
with beautiful houses.
Yes,
This is your future for the baby sort of thing.
And the only unpleasant person was the doctor, in my opinion, because... I might have said something about not wanting to give her up. And she said, "What have you to offer this child? What have you to offer?" You know, at your lowest point for her to say that.
Yeah.
And the midwife who delivered Deborah, she was a tall lady. And I think she had been married and entered late. And I remember saying to her, I can't give her up. And she said, "I think you'll make a great mother." And that's all I needed to hear. And then I set about, I was looking for a job in Cork. And I had an interview with this pub. They were giving me accommodation behind the pub. And I went to see the room, which was stacked up with crates of beer and everything behind the bar. And I said, "Oh, I can't do this." When I rang my mother, mm-hmm. I asked her, "What did my sister have?" And she was in Houston then. And I just said, "What did Marge have?" And she said, "What did you have?" Just like that. And then I broke down. So she said, "Come back in the evening," and she sent my 19-year-old brother and his friend to collect me. And it was just very sinister in the house.
Yeah.
This one here looked up through a knitted pram suit with coarse wool that I'd knitted first time in my life and smiled at my mother as if to say, "Are you taking me in?"
Yeah, that's amazing. And that changed everything. Still has the smile.
But okay. Then,
when you were going to have the baby, was the baby earmarked for adoption already? Were there homes waiting or a home waiting for the baby?
I got the feeling that because she was really healthy, there were some very weak little babies in that nursery. Nothing was said, but from the doctors, from what she said, I just felt she had someone lined up.
Yeah. OK. And you were meant to have the baby. The baby would find a dramatically beautiful home and you would be the scorned woman going back to whatever you were going to do without your baby in your hand, because they were the times. And it was, the midwife was a nun. Is that right?
Yes.
And the midwife turned around and said this.
She was a lovely smiling face. She just said, "I think you'll make a really good mother."
And that was enough for you to say, I'm not handing this baby away.
I couldn't. Yes, that was it.
And I thought, because in anything I read or see in the movies or whatever, the baby is taken away whether you like it or not. So how did you find yourself in a position where you could keep your baby?
Probably because I was older and there were different times. I know there's some awful stories out there. People had terrible experiences.
Yes.
I'm just saying that's my experience. I was that much older.
Now, your mother had kind of intimated that she didn't know you were pregnant and she was going along with the London story. Is that right?
Well, when you consider I was kind of a very shy child and always studious and didn't venture out a lot, you know.
Yeah.
I think in my circumstance, I would kind of know what my daughter would have done, you know. So I think she just chanced her arm there and said, what did you have? She kind of knew.
You were off having a baby.
And the fact that I was asking about my sister having a baby, she knew there was some, why are you asking about her having a baby, you know?
So you were spirited in the night back to the family home by your brother. And it was at that point that Deborah's killer smile won your stern mother over. And suddenly you had a home.
Well, not quite, because my oldest brother, was who had no children, he died at 52. He stood over me a day or two after coming home and he said, "Do you think your mother is going to raise that? You know, get on that phone and get him up, whoever owns it." So I had to ring their father and their parents came down. Long story short, that was December. I was married in January, on the 7th of January.
You didn't... neither of you wanted to get married, did you?
No, he didn't, no. And there was a time there where I went to a young curate and I said, "I've made up my mind to finish with him. I don't want to get married." So he came and talked to my parents, and my mother complained about him to the parish priest and said he was blocking this marriage. So he wanted to get Deborah fostered. And then my mother would say, "You don't want to get her fostered. Do you want to give her a name? Give her a name. If you get her fostered, you'll never see her." All this was going on. It was just pressure. So we were married. And I think we started the annulment procedure pretty soon after that. So the marriage was annulled eventually.
But it was important for you to keep Deborah.
Very. I can't explain. It was connection there, you know.
Oh, no, I did. Sorry, I didn't want to. It was important that you had that detail sorted out in
Do
order.
Do I not look lovable? Yeah.
Deborah, are you still here? I'm trying to talk to your mother.
You're trying to talk her out.
I know.
You keep smiling and it's distracting from the interview. I'm trying to talk
to
your mother.
I'm so sorry. I'm going all over the place because I'm very nervous.
You're doing really well, actually, which is great because it's such an unusual story. If we return to the point that you were saying that you got married and you went through that so that you could hang on to this beloved child, isn't that it? And that allowed you to keep Deborah in your life.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that kept me going was the art. It was an escape.
The art has been an important outlet for you, yeah.
Well, it's funny because my mother would ring me when these were little and say, "That bloody art, you're going to wreck their lives with that bloody art." You know, really encouraging.
Yeah.
And I feel now that it saved us all because my youngest daughter has an art gallery. Deborah, she has to paint. She's prolific. And the middle girl, she's a degree in art as well, but she's using it for therapy and teaching.
Great. You know, so three girls.
They're all into art.
All into art. So the gene is strong.
Well, yeah, it helped them to be a bit different. When they were in school, they were the only... I was the only single mother in Deborah's class, you know, in primary school. So there was that. And I think the fact that she was good at art helped her, would you say?
Well, yeah. Let's bring Deborah into the... hi,
the
Deborah.
Baby.
You're back. You're back. The baby.
What
is it like hearing that story?
It's very emotional. I mean, I've heard it growing up through my life. I suppose when I was getting married, I had to get the baptismal cert. And I was asking my mum, you know, I need the place, you know, where I was born. And we couldn't find it. The convent had closed down and a priest answered the phone. And he said, "You know, you're adopted."
Nice.
He basically said, "If you're looking for a cert from there, you're adopted." And I said, no, I'm not adopted." And he goes, "Yes, you are."
Like, because you were a rarity, obviously.
He said no one ever got to keep their babies in there. That gave me the shivers. And then I said it back to you. And then we went to watch Philomena together. You know, so that was...
What was that like?
Strange.
It was very pithy, Claire. Strange. But did you feel...
I was lucky.
Yeah.
The nuns treated me... I had a miscalling. They treated me like an equal.
Why did you say before we started our conversation that you'd probably get a backlash for painting a pretty picture?
I actually have a friend who had a bad experience. Now she's adopted. And when her adopted parents went to adopt a baby, they looked at all the babies and she was actually in another room. And then the nun said to her, you don't want to go in there. Those babies aren't thriving. So that's how she was selected. She said she was the weakest looking thing. Her mother adopted her.
Oh.
And she always hated her birthday. You know?
Yeah,
so that's one story there. My story was 44 years ago. Going back further, there were probably worse scenarios.
Yeah.
You know?
But you seem to have come out of it the other side.
I did. When you think about it.
And Deborah, what does this story mean to you, or how do you carry it?
I suppose I've grown up with it a lot. I do know that art is definitely a big part of our lives. Like, my mantra growing up, and your mantra was always expression beats depression, you know, and always paint it out of you. She did it all by herself, a single mother with three children. And
it's impressive. No, it is impressive. And you know, you're taking a moment now, because when you, a bit like expression beats depression, when you say things out physically, it kind of becomes more real and kind of maybe impressive.
Well, you also keep saying 44, my age, every few minutes.
Every time your mum says it,
I think that seems like a huge number.
Every time Claire says it, I see you wincing, and I think, Claire, enough with the age. You can just say, a number of years ago, I had a daughter. Because, you know, it's going to be a rough Christmas in your house now. Deborah keeps that attitude going. But you obviously admire your mum for what she did. I mean, what I take from it is your tenacity, actually. That you said, I'm not leaving here without that baby.
Maybe it's in all of us. Like, it made me work harder. It made me try. And one difference between the two of us, I used to take care of family, cooking. I'm a feeder. And first, and then paint when I'd be tired or sketch.
Sure.
This one here,
Deborah.
To hell with the house. Just paint the first thing in the morning. She's up in that studio.
It's
seven.
Amazing. It's like an addiction.
It is, yeah. I have to set the alarm clock when to stop painting and collect the kids. Like I
really? Is that full? Well, look, you very kindly brought me in a lovely toy show painting this morning of a puffin.
It's real. It's real.
Do you know what? It's actually a beautiful painting of a puffin. It's the nearest I'm going to get to one. So it'll have a proud place on my wall. But not only will it have a proud place on my wall, but also beside the gorgeous painting that your mum Claire has given me, a beautiful print, I might say, of one of my favourite walking spots, which is Dunleary Pier. That is so thoughtful of you. So thank you very much.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
Because you've enriched my life with that art. Art, there's something beautiful about having art. And, you know, this week more than ever, we keep saying it on the radio and on the TV as much as we can, that the artists need to be minded. And because we take it for granted sometimes, and they're in trouble now, and we need to be buying art for Christmas presents and supporting our friends who are whatever way they're doing it. But we'd be pretty poor society without it.
Yes.
But Deborah, deborahdonnelly.com, while we're here, let's mention it, because that's where people can sell, buy your paintings and from your Marley Park studio in Dublin. Congratulations on what you do. Thank you for coming in to share your story, because oftentimes when I see mother and child home, I kind of go, oh, we're in for a really sad story. And this could have been a much sadder story. Yes. But thanks to 44-year-old Deborah,
oh, God.
We now know that it wasn't always bad. And Claire, you're one hell of a mum.
Thank you. I forgot to mention.
Oh, you devil. Oh, that's so mean. That's such a Tuberty joke. Oh, that's so funny. We'd have done the exact same with ours. Claire, did you want to say something? Yeah. I mean, at 72, you're looking well enough now, I have to say.
We forgot to mention the Duke Street Gallery. Both our work are in the Duke Street Gallery in Dublin.
Yeah, the Duke Street Gallery, which is run by
Pamela, and it's in town.
It's in town.
Yeah, but both our work is there for Christmas.
Great. Well, I look forward to seeing it. And
thank you.
You can buy the work online, I take it, as well, which is important now, because we're not allowed to go into some of these shops. Okay, now there are no secrets left here. I'm 47. Okay.
Thanks for sharing.
Not at all. I just felt I complete the triumvirate as we're here. What a nice way to spend some time with you both. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And here's
to
happiness and warmth and love in your lives forever and ever. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You, Deborah.
Thank
I really enjoyed that. Muffins don't exist. We're going to be back with you a little later on. The text number is 51551. In his 50 years as a journalist, Bob Woodward has written 20 books and covered 9 presidents. The scope and the depth of his work have earned him a unique place in politics and journalism as perhaps the most enduring chronicler of American presidents. At either end of his front row seat to American history are two of the most divisive American presidents in generations, one Richard Milhouse Nixon and one Donald J. Trump. His latest book, Rage, is fascinating, which you've all either read or you heard about by now. It's another bestseller, no surprise at all. What a pleasure it is to welcome to the program Bob Woodward. Good morning, Bob, and thanks for your time this morning.
Morning.
What did you think of Donald Trump before he took up residence in Pennsylvania Avenue?
Well, you know what? I spent for this book about 9 hours interviewing him at the end of last year and this year, and it's very clear he sees the world very differently. He thinks he's done a good job fighting the coronavirus. He thinks he's done more for black people in the United States than anyone other than Abraham Lincoln. He feels he's done a great job appointing judges, and he feels he talks about the economy the way it was before the virus and the way he thinks it's going to be. But, of course, in those four areas, there is lots of failure, particularly on the virus. I think he's just he once told me when I asked him what the job of the president is, he said it's to protect the people, and he's failed in that miserably.
I suppose when you are heading into confront this presidency with this particular book, Rage, you had a good idea of what sort of a person you're dealing with. When you consider the amount of time you spent talking to him, 18 interviews, that's a lot of tape. What do you make of the man rather than the president?
Well, as a reporter, I'm more interested in his behavior and his attitudes. And as I said to him, I always think the spine, the core of the American presidency, is the policy. In other words, what he's actually doing. So I tend to focus on that. Mm. But behind that is this man, Donald Trump, who has stirred probably the biggest controversy, certainly since Nixon, in this country. And Trump and I got into some shouting matches. He's not organized. A president needs to build a team of people, but he operates on impulse, and he sends out these tweets with major decisions. So it is a failure on his part to use the best people in the government and the best people in this country. And the failure is monumental.
Why is it, Bob, that the president told you that he always wanted to play the virus down? And why is it that he mocks Joe Biden for wearing a mask? And why is it that he calls Dr. Fauci, the most eminent scientist in the land, a clown? Why does he do this?
He does it because he's Trump, because he feels that he's got a particular insight into what people in this country want. Now, there is a certain base, maybe it's 40% of the country, I'm not sure what it is, that does feel that way. But he talks that way because he feels that way. And, of course, a president is a human being, but part of leading, part of being an adult is learning how to curtail some of those emotions. And Trump does not. He just lets it all hang out. And what he's done on the virus and the failure, like to listen to Dr. Fauci now, who's probably the most preeminent infectious disease specialist in the world, not just in the United States, the failure to wear a mask, which, as we now know, if they had done that beginning back in February, in the days after President Trump was warned explicitly about the coming pandemic, if they'd done some of these things in February, we might have control of the virus rather than the virus having control of us. What's going on in Ireland with the virus?
The virus in Ireland sees us, as of last night at midnight, on level 5, full lockdown for 6 weeks, Bob.
Wow. So, there you are. People are living it.
Yes, but we also are looking to our health experts and indeed our government for guidance, and one is by and large trusting the other.
That's essential, and you know, I wish the world luck on this. And as we get into the cold seasons, it's going to get worse, according to the doctors.
Bob, is it a New York Times reading, Democrat loving, left leaning comment to suggest that President Trump is without empathy?
Well, I found in my dealings with him, and in the first book, Fear, I wrote on Trump that came out in 2018, he's capable of some empathy, but his focus is on himself as a political being and is somebody who has the emotions. So there's not a display of that, and of course, there's so much contrary evidence. He says such cruel things about people. He literally, after he got the virus, was saying, you know, don't be obsessed about it. He feels better than he's ever felt in 20 years. And then he literally said a couple of days ago, it's a blessing from God that he got the virus. Now, there are 8 million families in this country who've had somebody close to them or somebody in their immediate family get the virus. That's 8 million people, and over 220,000 people dying in this country. And he should express remorse and sadness about that, but instead he's on this emotional run that is beyond Orwellian.
In your book, In Rage, you get this sense that you are the ultimate, you forgive the analogy, but you're the ultimate fly on the wall in so many of these meetings, thanks to your contacts and what have you. And you get General Mattis, for example, or Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence at the time, kind of griping about Trump as being dangerous or unfit. But surely, Bob, the greatest fuel for tyranny is silence. And if these men felt that strongly about the man running your country, should they not have been less silent, them and most, if not all, of the Republican Party?
Well, it's particularly for people in the military, they don't want to say things publicly that will make it look like they've taken a political position. You know, I understand it, and we now know in the book in great detail exactly how Mattis, who was the Secretary of Defense for Trump the first 2 years, somebody respected, experienced general, was just at war with Trump for 2 years and finally resigned, couldn't take it, as I quote him in the book, saying that he had been asked to do lots of stupid things, but in the end, when Trump wanted to pull the few American troops out of Syria fighting ISIS, he felt that was felony stupid, and he quit.
Do you believe that Vladimir Putin has something, some dirt on Donald Trump?
What I report is that Dan Coats, who was the head of intelligence after 9/11, a Republican senator for 16 years, was going into retirement. Trump tapped him to take this job. Coats was very close to Pence, the vice president, and so Coats took the job and found, when they looked through all the top secret intelligence, they couldn't find anything to prove that Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, had some secret or illegal leverage on Trump, but they always suspected it because of the way Trump acts. I found it extraordinary that the head of intelligence would reach this conclusion because of Trump's behavior, because of his continuous kowtowing to Putin.
You said recently that Trump is assassinating the presidency.
Yeah, well, Trump is assassinating the presidency because as we are, what, less than 2 weeks before the election here, Trump has made continuous statements that he will not accept a peaceful transfer of power. He has said we can't count on the electoral system, of course, which is the basis in any democracy for constitutional legitimacy for the president of the United States. He is assassinating the office and its responsibilities to make sure that democracy continues. And so now we're going to have an election. And when do we get the results? When are people going to accept the results? There's lots of mail-in voting. He's criticized that. I mean, already, I think 30 million people in this country have voted. The president should be the person organizing and making sure that it's a fair system. But for him to attack it so directly, I call it, yes, an assassination, because that's what it is.
I think that when the president refused to confirm a peaceful transfer of power, that was arguably the most frightening point of the presidency for a lot of people watching it.
Isn't it? I mean, I know there in Ireland, I mean, your system is, your politics has gone much more progressive. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in this country with Trump, it is the opposite. But, you know, however you might label it, progressive or conservative, the job of the government is to look out for the people. And he has not done that. Government needs to have authority and authenticity. And for the president in this way to attack the very system is absolutely unbelievable, but that's the reality we're dealing with here.
A lot of us are watching this election so closely, Bob, even in Ireland, and wondering about the polls and the polling. I don't think we've ever been so keenly aware of what's happening. But the difficulty for us is that a lot of people were burned by what happened to Hillary Clinton and feel that the polls might be essentially a work of fiction.
Yes, I don't trust polls. And in fact, in one of the interviews with Trump, he cited some poll, and I said, you don't believe polls, do you? And he said, no, he doesn't, because people will not speak honestly. There is no way you are going to credibly measure public opinion. And as you point out, in 2016, the polling was wrong. Kept saying that Hillary Clinton is going to win. Now, the really interesting thing going on now is the secret private polling of both the Republicans and the Democrats is trying to measure not just what people say, but the level of commitment to their candidate. And this inquiry establishes, but it's not, they're really not public about it, that Trump voters are sitting home and they're saying, I am going to get to the polls for sure. I am going to make sure I vote. And there are a lot of Biden voters who are supportive of Biden, but that intensity that I am going to vote no matter what feeling is not as high. And if Biden's going to win, they're going to have to really get into making sure that people get to the polls. I do not think we know who's going to win. I indicate very skeptical of the polls. I think, as I said, Trump is skeptical of the polls, though he will cite them and distort them. And so we are going into a period where we don't know the outcome, we don't know how we're going to measure it accurately, and whether the sitting president of the United States is going to accept the outcome. He's made it very clear he thinks it's going to be rigged because of all of this mail-in voting. And just think about it for a moment. Under our system, the election is November 3rd. The various states have indicated for days or maybe a week or longer are not going to be able to announce who won their state, Trump or Biden. But whatever, we have November, December, and most of January until a new president takes office or Trump takes office again. So that's 3 months that Trump is going to be president still have that extraordinary power of that office in this country. And having done reporting on 9 presidents, Nixon through Trump, that's 20% of the presidents we've had, that the concentration of power in the presidency has only gone up. And so Trump, by seizing control of the communication system in this country, I don't mean illegally, just by doing the unexpected and exercising his power, that he has probably more power than any president, certainly since Nixon.
Who will history be kinder to, Bob? Will it be kinder to Nixon or Trump?
It's a great question, and clearly Nixon was a criminal, and that's why his own political party, the Republican Party, forced him out of office and made it clear he didn't have the support, and so Nixon voluntarily resigned. In the case of Trump, the crimes have not been proven, but just look at the calamity of the Vietnam War to the United States. Maybe 58,000 people, soldiers, men and women in the military service died in that war. Now in the pandemic, we have 4 times that number that have died. I don't think Trump could have stopped all of the deaths, but he certainly could have organized the country and responded to the pandemic honestly, and the failure to meet that responsibility has led to a catastrophe. I think when history is written, what Trump's failure to heed the warnings he was given is going to be probably the story of the failure of the American presidency and the American system to nominate and elect someone who responsibly would carry out the duties of president. And Trump's actions are not only a calamity, but they're irresponsible. I think there's a moral dimension to all of this because of the depth and magnitude of the failure.
As we draw our conversation to a close, Bob, an Irish commentator said recently that we've had so much things and feelings towards America. We've had great sense of excitement and joy and gratitude in many ways, but we've never felt the emotion that seems to a lot of people feel towards America. People feel sorry for America. I never thought I'd see this day. You write yourself more recently that you're embarrassed for the president, but you're embarrassed for the country. What an extraordinary state of affairs, Bob.
Yes, it is. Trump has failed the people who support him, the people who didn't support him. He's failed the country. He has failed his political party, the Republican Party, and he's failed himself. And it is an embarrassment, and I'm not surprised to hear you report that people in Ireland feel pity for the United States. I mean, imagine that, you know, all of the economic strength we've had, the collective military and diplomatic strength that we've had to lead the world or participate in that leadership of making sure that we have alliances so we avoid wars. And now Trump has put all of that at risk. We don't know the outcome. You know, the next couple of weeks and the weeks after the election, as this hopefully gets sorted out, going to be one of the most monumental weeks in American history.
Mm. Can you do me a favor, Bob, as we've just entered lockdown in Ireland, could you give me a bit of hope, please? give us all a bit of hope in terms of, have you any optimism in you at all?
Yes. I mean, I think the people in this country are good. I think that the polarization that's political that has taken place, you know, maybe somebody can come in. Maybe if Joe Biden's elected, I think he has the temperament to know that you have to bring people together. I think if he's elected president, the first week he would invite Republican leaders to the White House and sit down and say, you know, we need to bury the hatchet, so to speak, on some of these issues and work together in a way for the public interest, because the public interest is what matters. And I think I've known him for decades. I think he has the capacity to not fight old wars and to move on and to put in place some programs and structure to heal, because a lot of healing is going to be required. If Trump's reelected, are we going to have more of the divisions and hostility and hate? I mean, there is just a hatefulness that is so contrary to the best traditions of our political system.
You know something, Bob Woodward, if it all goes pear-shaped, you and Elsa Walsh, your wife, can come to Ireland, live in Cork, and write another book. How about that?
Well, thank you. We were in Ireland last year visiting her family. Her parents came from County Cork. I know you know that.
Yeah.
And we visited some of her relatives there, and we went to the horse races. And, you know, as you know, Dublin and the area is one of the beauty spots of the world, and I hope we can return and not have to wear our masks.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing you back in Ireland sometime soon. Bob, thank you so much. Not at all. Thank you for your time today. We wish you well, and here's to brighter days ahead.
Same to you, sir.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's Bob Woodward, a remarkable figure in journalism and, dare I say it, history, talking to us this morning about his book, Rage. If, like me, you love American history and politics, Rage will be a very welcome addition to your bookshelf. Fascinating insight into an extraordinary time in American history. The text number is 51551.